The topic that has been assigned to me is One Hope of Your Calling. And you'll recall that in the words from Ephesians 4, this takes its place as one of the seven ones that are given almost in a great doxology after those first verses. I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all lowliness and meekness, with patience, forbearing one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And then the ones begin. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of us all, who is above all and through all and in all. Now, the section that has been given to me as the label for our thought this afternoon is this phrase, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call. And the label then is One Hope of Your Calling. But it seems to me that what we're interested in talking about is not so much the one hope, although I should add at once, this is really the only thing that we are interested in talking about, because the one hope is, of course, the whole gospel put together in two words. And in that sense, we are interested once more in talking about this gospel to make sure that the call has reached through to us, that we are hearing the call, and that we are the more moved to heed it, to follow the call. But at the same time, I think that our interest this afternoon, in order to make sure that the speakers that follow me will have some opportunity to connect up with what I am about to say, wants to move more in the direction of the calling. In the sense of the whole matter of the Christian vocation, the situation in which we find ourselves as people who are called. So that if we were to have answered an ad, one of these old Charles Atlas ads, I don't know if they still run in the magazines, where all of you 97-pound weaklings could be shown the hope, you see, of Charles Atlas's calling, where you would be that mighty man on the beach. We could, you see, have spent our time talking about the muscle aspect of this. We could be talking about the hope, where it is possible, if you continue with these exercises, you will attain. But what we're really interested in dealing with is the process by which we can make that calling, that hope, become actually effective in our life right now. So that if we were a group gathered together in such an exercise course, we would not want Charles Atlas simply to be talking about the hope. But we would like to have him say, well, what shall we do? What are the exercises that will enable us to reach this particular thing? Well, to this direction then, I would like first of all to make a start out of Bonhoeffer's The Cost of Discipleship and use a quick quote from the beginning of one of his messages on the call to discipleship to accent for us once more this big major point that we are the called people. That we have been called, that we are called. And this is, of course, the area of the hope. But let's talk about it for a moment again to make sure that we know what it is that draws us, what it is that is luring us on into the life of the Christian, or to say it in another way, what is the power of God that is thrusting us forward into this kind of an existence? Well, this is a message that is based on the passage from Mark 2. Our Lord passed by and saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the place of toll, and he saith unto him, follow me. And he arose and followed him. And now Bonhoeffer. The call goes forth, and it is at once followed by the response of obedience. The response of the disciples is an act of obedience, not a confession of faith in Jesus. How could the call immediately evoke obedience? The story is a stumbling block for the natural reason. And it is no wonder that frantic attempts have been made to separate the two events. By hook or by crook, a bridge must be found between them. Something must have happened in between, some psychological or historical event. Thus we get the stupid question, surely the publican must have known Jesus before, and that previous acquaintance explains his readiness to hear the Master's call. Unfortunately, our text is ruthlessly silent on this point. And in fact, it regards the immediate sequence of call and response as a matter of crucial importance. it displays not the slightest interest in the psychological reasons for a man's religious decisions. And why? For the simple reason that the cause behind the immediate following of call by response is Jesus Christ himself. It is Jesus who calls, and because it is Jesus, Levi follows at once. This encounter is a testimony to the absolute, direct, and unaccountable authority of Jesus. There is no need of any preliminaries, and no other consequence but obedience to the call. Because Jesus is the Christ, he has the authority to call and to demand obedience to his word. Jesus summons men to follow him, not as a teacher or a pattern of the good life, but as the Christ, the Son of God. In this short text, Jesus Christ and his claim are proclaimed to men. Not a word of praise is given to the disciple for his decision for Christ. We are not expected to contemplate the disciple, but only him who calls and his absolute authority. According to our text, there is no road to faith or discipleship, no other road, only obedience to the call of Jesus. And what does the text inform us about the content of discipleship? Follow me. Run along behind me. And that, of course, is the point of the whole presentation this afternoon. As soon as we begin to say, you are the called ones, you have been called, what we are saying at once is that this call, having come from Jesus Christ, expects of you obedience. So that, Bonhoeffer says a little later, only he who believes is obedient, and only he who is obedient believes. And this becomes one great package then. If we are the called people, we are going to be the calling people. But look to this for a moment again. You have been called, and you need to be convinced again. You need to be convinced every day, not just in this conference, that you actually have been called. And I think that it is possible to say on the basis of this quotation once more that baptism has really been God's call to you, as emphatic, as real, as actual, as was the call when Jesus Christ walked by and in person tapped the shoulder of Levi and said, follow me. All of you who have been baptized have received the Spirit's impact on your life, the Spirit's invitation, the Spirit's compulsion to move after him. And this does not require some kind of mental ability on our part that we can translate into some kind of an intellectual faith. The grace of God already in baptism put its thrust into our lives to move us into discipleship. This is one thing that we ought to be conscious of. But I think that we can move on, because God's grace has let us live this long, to assert that we have met Jesus Christ in his word made words. And when these words touch us, it is as certainly true as if God himself in Jesus Christ were calling to us. When God really wanted to make his word actual, his action to make men act, when he wanted to make that action become personal in the lives of people, he put the word into flesh and laid it in the manger. And when he now wants to make that same compulsion, that same thrust to action, real in your life, he puts it into words, whether those words be in print or whether they be in vocables spoken and reaching your ear by the vibrations of sound waves. This is God actually coming down and starting to push you, move you, thrust you into the direction that he wants you to go. And this is what is happening right this moment. And if we are going to talk about the hope of our calling, what we are talking about is God pushing us right now, drawing us right now into the realization that we are the called people and that the calling requires obedience. And let's deliberately do it for a moment. Let's stop to let God call us. I've mentioned to John and to, if there are any others that are in that class here, I have to look around suspiciously to see, that an interesting illustration of this came to my attention from Mr. Music Man of the Lutheran Hour recently, Carl Schalk, who was with Dr. Hoffman out on the West Coast for a Lutheran Hour rally, and he described how they attended the service at the church in which Paul Schulze is pastor. And at the close of the service, the pastor announced that they had distinguished guests in their audience, and then asked Dr. Hoffman to come forward and say a few words as to why he was out on the West Coast. And then he asked him a few questions, what's with the Lutheran hour, what's with the rally. And then he said, it's almost time for us to go to dinner, and you've got to get over to the rally. Now, you've come all the way out to the West Coast, all the way from the East Coast. You've come from the Christians way out there in the East, and you've worshipped here with Christians in the West. Now, before you go back, tell us the gospel. I mean, this is gorgeous, isn't it? What would you have said if that's the way they had presented the platform for you? Tell us the gospel. I don't know exactly what Dr. Hoffman said, but it's exactly the situation in which we stand right now. It is not that you do not know the call of God on your life. It is not that you are not aware of the fact that Jesus Christ, when he puts his hand upon you and says, follow, demands obedience, expects obedience. But it is that we as Christians, gathered together from the four corners of our land, would like to hear the gospel once again. And how would we go about saying it? Well, it's a tremendous thing to know that God has actually placed his Son, Jesus Christ, in the midst of us, for where we are gathered together in his name. There he is. And this is the way God went about it, to make sure that we couldn't miss. He put himself down into our midst. Some of you know the illustration of Bailey that I have perhaps used too often, of how when man was created, they were standing in a large circle around about God, and there was no missing the fact that God was the center of life. But when men turned their backs upon God and turned the circle inside out, then God maintained his position in the center, but no one was any longer looking at him, instead looking out into the darkness, so that what light came from God simply cast frightening shadows out there on the periphery. And God could have stayed there and said, if men want me, they can find where I am. Instead, he made himself of no reputation and came out here on the periphery where men were looking in order that they might be confronted with the kind of God that God is. And when people saw God in Jesus Christ, and when they heard his words, he that hath seen me hath seen the Father, and when they saw what he did, cheer up, my son, your sins are forgiven. Rise and walk. When they saw all this, they said, if God is like that, I'm going back. And he had turned them, and they were turned. And this is what happens now as we talk about it again. We are saying to each other, this Jesus Christ, this is God. And God has come down to reach you and to speak to you. And to say to you, God is like this, and God wants you like this, turned around once more in that inner circle, joined hands as the brotherhood, one unity, one spirit, one body, around God, who is the center of all our life and existence. This is what he has done. And this he did by grace, not because of something in us, as Dr. Harn said so strongly last night. And this he did at a great price. For it was not simply a matter of Jesus Christ suddenly flashing across the face of our world, that men might see him and say, there went God. But that they were here, in this person of Jesus Christ, enabled to recognize him, was only a part of the great peace and of the great price. He had to give up his life. In the mystery of this means by which God made sin forgiven, Jesus Christ died and paid himself the penalty of the punishment for sin. It was at a great price that he did it. And it was God's plan, not ours, as though we could say, first let me bury my father and then I will follow. First let me do this, or if you see it my way, I'll join up. It was God's plan, and he said, follow me, and there was no cause, no Roman government, no books to keep, nothing that would serve as an excuse to keep our obedience from being the immediate response to the call. And I suppose we could say it now in terms of the great hope, because this is what he holds up before us. Not simply a great hope for a life that is beyond this world, but the great hope of being once more in a fellowship with God, man's chief end, to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. And I suppose we ought to add to that, to enjoy one another too, in time and forever. The great hope is that it is possible once more for people like us who have turned our backs upon God to be so turned by him and so united to one another that we could be part of the inner company, part of the people of God who are in the world and yet not of the world, sharing with one another life as it really ought to be lived, and connected with God in such a way that we find the rest for our souls and know the happiness of being in tune with the Almighty. This is the great hope, that salvation, which begins now, might be something that would be ours all through these days, that would give meaning and purpose to the daily round of existence, and that would continue on and on into the forevers that the mercy and the wisdom of God still has in touch for us. This is the great hope, and this is the thing which is ours right now, because God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. Well, this, I say, is the thing that happens when we begin to talk about the fact that we really are called. This is the thing that happens when we begin to talk again about what God did in Jesus Christ. We feel the call. And it's as real a thing as though, well, those of you who have little babies, brothers and sisters, or who are beginning to pick up nephews and nieces, or I guess there are a few of you who have grandchildren, and know the feel of the baby who suddenly grabs your thumb. Well, this is the reach of God into our life, as real as that, as intimate, as warm. The child Jesus illustrates it, and yet it is a grab by God that is bigger than this, that reaches through to us in all the areas of our life. God holding on to you and saying, I love you, I trust you to be part of my working group, I want you to be part of the unity of the Spirit. And this is the call that has reached us. And our answer is already reflected in the way we feel right this moment. It's been reflected in all of the things we've been doing in this conference. It's reflected in our answer to the call as it sees us working out our life for God in the various places in which he has placed us. But this then is the challenge that makes the second point. You are supposed to shape up to the call. He's called you, now make sure that you are being that called person. Bonhoeffer's there. The big thrust that only he who believes is obedient, and only he who is obedient believes. And it's a faith without works and a works without faith kind of thing. And now we need to look at it. Well, I would like to say it in about three different ways with some quotations. I think that if we're going to make sure that we shape up to the kind of called person we need to be, that we walk worthy of the calling, as the first verse of this chapter urges upon us, that we need to be very careful that we are not offended by the gospel, that we do not let this thing that God has done for us in Jesus Christ finally become the thing that begins to push us out of the way. Now, I don't know whether this will help you, but I found it a strangely moving kind of an illustration. This is from the Saturday Review. It's an article by Lillian Smith, Strange Fruit Smith, and this seems to me to be a strange kind of fruit from Strange Fruit Smith, and it's called A Strange Kind of Love. But I think it is a very pertinent illustration of the kind of thing that can happen to us when the love of Jesus Christ reaches into our lives. She gives the sample of how people react against the nonviolent resistance approach of the Negro in the South. And if you will translate as I read this and put in the place of these non-resistors the person of Jesus Christ, who comes with the love of God, ready to be silent in the face of all accusations, ready to bear in himself all the evil that men could throw against him, and then see whether or not the reaction, the negative reaction against this overwhelming love of Christ, is not something that oftentimes goes on within our own lives. Think of this, because I'm trying to say, if we want to be the called person, we've got to be careful that we do not be pushed aside by this offense of the gospel. Lillian Smith says there is another cause for the resentment of methods used by the nonviolent group. Many suffer a severe psychic difficulty in dealing with this strange love. Compassion from someone you consider beneath you or whom you have harmed enrages you if you are easily enraged. A forgiving spirit in a Negro can, as one man said to me, make you want to tear him to pieces. What is he forgiving me for? What have I done? Things boil inside. Guilt chokes kindness. Arrogance claws at fairness. The truth is that we can meet nonviolence creatively only if we respect nonviolence. We can relate to compassion only if somewhere in us there exists a little compassion. We can give justice only if we value justice. We can respond to humor in some of these situations only if we value humor. The nonviolent philosophy is a catalyst, powerful and difficult in its spiritual demands. And there is something else. It is human not to want to be put in a position where we act or despise ourselves for not acting. The Negro's nonviolent protests bring to a town its moment of truth. We can no longer slide along complacently. We are compelled to make decisions, right or wrong. Suppose, for instance, you walk into a drugstore where Negro students are sitting in at the lunch counter. There they are, quietly sitting on the stools, usually reading school books, sometimes the Bible. You watch. Suddenly, white hoodlums edge in. One slaps a student, another sticks a burning cigarette in his back. The students do not move. Every muscle in you aches to help these students, and yet you do nothing. You would tackle the hoodlums, maybe, but you tell yourself you might start a riot, and you might. And suddenly you are sick with guilt. How can you stand there? Then as suddenly anger overcomes your guilt and you yell silently to the students, fight back. But the nonviolent protesters just sit there, taking the blows, the burning cigarette. Now something else happens inside you. A nasty, indecent something whispers, okay, cowards, let the hoodlums use the chain on you. See if I care. You walk out. You have not done or said a thing. But you are sick all over, for you do care what happens. You can't help but care. And suddenly you are raging mad with yourself and with the hoodlums and with the students, and you settle the stinging turmoil inside you by saying, it is these Negroes who are disturbing the peace of our town. Things were fine until they came. Or maybe you are a prominent businessman sitting in your office trying to make a profitable deal for your firm, and beyond you is this spiritual turmoil, this challenge. You know it concerns you and your children, but there is this deal to pull off, so you turn your moment of truth over to the chief of police and tell him to handle those Negroes who are disturbing the peace. Whose peace? Yours? The hoodlums? They have certainly disturbed something in your town, but not its peace. Only its apathy, its complacency, its paralysis in the face of a changing, whirling world that won't wait, no matter how loudly we Americans, South or North, beg it to wait. And they have mixed up your values. They have disturbed your peace of soul and mind. For we have not measured up to the moral challenge offered us, the biggest that will be offered us in our lifetime. Now, I contend if you take the love of God in Jesus Christ and put it into that, you begin to see where the problem sometimes lies in our own living. For God comes demanding of us action. And we have looked at the demand for action not once, but repeatedly. And because of the big deals we're trying to pull off, we have said, somebody else deal with this intrusion by the love of God into our world of non-love. And as a result, we are often tempted, if not to hate, then to scorn, or certainly to thrust aside the compelling demand that the vocation of God in Jesus Christ places into our living. And so I am saying, if we are going to recognize that the call is real, we need to recognize at once that our shaping up to the call must be real, and we ought never let this offense of the gospel so to be used by our old Adam that we reject both God and his demands. Rather, we ought to make sure that this strange love that reaches us in Jesus Christ be the thing that transforms the hatred within us and make us admit the guilt of our refusal to follow, in order that facing up to what we have not been, we may by the Spirit be changed into the things which he would have us to be. We can say it possibly in another way. You have to be careful of the distortions that come into you from contemporary churchism. And here I would like to use again, if those of you who have heard me do this will please not be scornful, two examples that are not biblically true, but are a combination of what we have done with accents because of the way the church has filled itself around us. To some of the instances in the scripture. I'd like to read to you Exodus 3, beginning at the first verse, and you will be able to tell when I stop reading Exodus. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian,
And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and lo, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I am deeply impressed. And he walked around the bush taking photographs from various angles. For he said, these will look good in my scrapbook. And by them I will always remember the day the Lord called me.
And the second reading is from the ninth chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, beginning with the first verse.
But Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Now as he journeyed, he approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven flashed about him. And Saul was moved and emotionally excited, and promised never to persecute Christians again. And he returned to the city and joined the First Christian Church of Jerusalem, and was in church every Sunday for the rest of his life. And we're satisfied with this kind of performance sometimes in our own living. And it's the kind of thing that contemporary churchism is apt to thrust in the way of the call and the obedience. And I'm trying to say once more, if we are to recognize that faith is obedience, but obedience is faith, we need to be careful that the distortions that are always trying to crowd in on us because of the way the church in our community, in our experience, sometimes in our membership, has expressed itself in our world. And we need to recognize that something much bigger than this has happened, that God actually has appeared to us, and that this burning bush, this flame of fire, this word in words, this word in water, this word in bread and wine, is God himself tapping us upon the shoulder? Is God himself giving us the food for renewed strength? Is God in a vision, in a blinding flash? Is Jesus Christ saying, I am Jesus whom thou persecutest? Is Jesus saying, I have a great work for you to do? You are a chosen vessel. This we need to recognize. We'll take one other example. This is from the October 26th Time magazine. Some of you probably saw the article about Pflugerville Eber Alles. To the German-descended citizens of Pflugerville, Texas, population 400, the most important things in life in approximate order are chores, church, and football. White-faced cattle graze on Pflugerville's gently rolling farms, and snowy cotton flourishes in the rich black land soil. On the Sabbath, almost the whole town turns out at the Lutheran church. But Friday is football day, and then placid Pflugerville twangs with tension. Each time the high school Pflugerville Panthers take the field, they carry with them the winningest record in schoolboy football. In 52 straight games stretching back to 1957, Pflugerville High is unbeaten and untied. Technically, the Panthers play Class B ball, not in the same league as the Class AAAA juggernauts from the big city schools in Dallas. But to the 1,000 or more fiercely partisan fans who cram old Fritz Pfluger's renovated cow pasture for each home game, they seem as good as the pros. Since 1958, they have scored 2,073 points to the opposition's 223, and it looks as if it may be Pflugerville Eber Alles forever. Toddlers practice cross-body blocks under the goal posts while the high schoolers pummel their opponents on the field. Fourth graders get written permission from their mothers to play tackle football, and organized competition begins in the fifth grade. The junior high school team has not lost a game since 1956. By the time the youngsters get to high school, they are fully indoctrinated. There are only 40 boys in school, and all but 9 suit up for the team. 7 do not play because they are ineligible, 1 because he is team manager, and 1 because his parents won't let him. In schoolboy fanatic Pflugerville, this is a scandal. We think it's terrible, says Coach Charles Kimple, 30. While the other boys are playing football, he is in the study hall with girls. Now, I suppose there are two ways you could use this illustration. One, to say that the Christian ought to be as wise as a serpent, even though he may be as gentle as a dove. And who can say that this boy is so stupid? But this is not the way I would like to use it. Let's imagine that that boy actually has an approach to this whole football fanaticism that would be in agreement with his parents. Let's say he has grown up beyond the situation in which he used to say,
I can't do that
because my watch won't let me. Are you aware of the parallel I'm trying to draw now? He has gotten to the point where he no longer attempts to oppose the temptations of a world that's trying to crush out the response to vocation by using the church rules as his alibi. He has come to the point where he recognizes that if there is a demand of Jesus Christ upon me, it must be my response as a Jesus person that reacts to it. And let's say then that in this illustration, he has come to the decision that there are some other things in life more important than playing football. In fact, he maybe has even recognized that there are so many things tied up with this whole big major stress on football that it makes it almost imperative for him to get out of it if he is to be himself. Let's say this has happened. Now, this boy is under terrific pressure. All of the others, those who are ineligible, of course, they don't have the pressure. They can just say, well, I don't know. I mean, they're just too dumb, maybe. But he knows, and let's say he's got the brawn, too. He's past the 98-pound weakling stage. And so he doesn't have this alibi. In spite of what he could be a star this or that. He decides, no, I'm going to go up to the study room, girls or no girls. Well, this is the kind of pressure that the Christian is in. And this is the kind of place that the Christian ought to see himself in. In a world that has set up standards that are totally different from his, but which he too is drawn to and attracted to. In a world that has made its goals so different, but goals which he himself really longs to follow. Now he knows better, but he wants something less, and he has to maintain a position through years of this kind of compulsion, not just from the people in school, which is the strongest, but around town, too, the city-odity. Well, this is the Christian. And all we're trying to say once more is that if we are to be the obedient people of faith, the faithful people of obedience, we need to recognize that in the face of opposition of the world and of the church itself, where it has failed to be the church, and in the opposition that arises in the old man because of the push of the gospel into our lives, we must insist that the Spirit's voice be followed and that we be the people God has called us to become. And so, I suppose that we should say, in summary, that if we are to obey St. Paul's injunction to be walking worthy of the vocation with which we are called, to be following this summary of the one hope of our calling, then we need to recognize the very simultaneous callings that are present in our living. And they're easy to list. We have a calling in the parish. We have a calling in the family. We have a calling in our friendships. We have a calling in our citizenship. We have a calling in our school. And we have a calling in our breadwinning occupation. And all of these are places in which the called person must fit. These are the study halls in which God's call has placed us. In the midst of the playing fields of the world, in the midst of the rah-rahism of the world, in the midst of the, you've got to be a football hero if you want to get along with it. You remember this old one, do you? It's probably so old most of you don't. In the midst of all of this, we have to see the study hall of the parish. Now, it doesn't make any difference what else is going on in the parish. We're talking about the study hall of the parish. The girls are there, and brother, you're the only boy. So that even in the parish, the problem is that you might not be exercising your calling, neither catching the call of God to you, nor giving the response, which in this sense is the passing on of the call to the others that are in the parish, that we edify one another, that within the framework of the Christian congregation, we are sounding the call so that nobody can miss it. The same thing can be said in every other study hall, the family. When we are in the study hall of the family, how easy it is to always hurt the one you love kind of thing. Where we can say, well, if we're polite to one another, what else can you expect between a brother and a sister? To say that Jesus Christ wants us somehow to be talking the gospel to one another, well, this we're apt to miss. And the study hall turns itself into something which is obviously not the playing field, but what's the good of putting on a hair shirt if the objective is not ultimately the work of the gospel? Now, I want to say right at this point that I would like to close with reading some material out of Salinger's Fanny and Zooey, and I'm surprised to myself how many of these things begin to be echoed in this material. Because if those of you who have read this remember, Franny is the sister of Zooey, and this is quite a family. They've all been quiz kids for years, and they were on radio for many years as the bright quiz kids who could give the answers to all of these things. And Franny, in the opening episode of the book, is trying to make meaning out of life by starting off on the Jesus Prayer, in which one is constantly contemplating vocally, at least interiorly vocally, on Jesus Christ, asking him to have mercy. And the theory is that in this process, they will be so gathered up into a fellowship with Jesus Christ as to make life different. And as a result, she has become disenchanted with everything else in the world, and she is venting her disenchantment upon her family. So that in the last part of the book, she is at home in the Glass household, and everybody else is having trouble because Franny is having troubles. But it is here that you find a demonstration of a brother really going out to communicate Jesus Christ to his sister. Think about this for a moment, because this is one of the playing fields. The same thing is true in friendships. When we start to operate on a dating level with, shall you date someone of another church? How often this thing then boils into, well, at least talk about what church you belong to. How hard it is, even here, to move your way down to the point where you begin talking about what is Jesus Christ going to mean to us in this relationship right now, as well as in any potential marriage situation. Well, go through the playing field, the citizenship situation, the school situation, in the fact that right now our calling by God is that we will be obedient where we are in the university or college. And ultimately in the breadwinning occupation, whether it be faithfulness as a person who is called in this other sense into the holy ministry, or called in this specific sense to a full-time church vocation, or called into any of the other places in which God wants us to do a job on earth while we do his job on earth. Always the question in our minds is, are we actually shaping up? Are we turning the study hall into a place in which we really exercise the big activity which God wants us to follow? Well, that's it, really. But I can't find any other group where I would be able to read this to, and so I thought I would read it to you. Many of you have read it, and if you've read it, you'll be glad if I'm going to read it to you. If you haven't read it, you ought to hear it, and you've got to think this parable through. I don't think that I'll try to make any comment, because this tends to spoil it, like when you read poetry. I should say, too, by the time you get to page 191, where I'd like to start, you've become somewhat inured to the lowercase God damn that stand as adjectives, nouns, and almost pronouns in every other part of speech in this, which one cannot excuse, but I think which one can begin to live with once you've come this far, mostly because here is a voice that is saying much of what we're saying, and it's coming from a point of view which is somewhat different from our own, and as a result, it has a certain amount of compulsion. Well, I think that those of you that have read it will remember that after Franny has almost gone into a nervous breakdown because she not only can not live with herself, she's not getting close enough to God, but she can't stand anybody else because they're so obviously far away from God, her brother really reads her the riot act, and then when she collapses under this, he walks out, and then he goes across the hall into his older brother's room, and there he calls her up from the telephone in his brother's room, and she has to answer the telephone. And now he imitates the one brother that she's willing to listen to. And this is the way the thing starts. He's trying to pull it over on her at the beginning, but she catches on very soon. And now watch this thing happen. He's trying to tell her, if you're really going to be living the Christian life, you've got to be living it right now. That's one thing. And the other thing he's trying to tell her is that if you're really going to be living the Christian call, the obedience to the faith in Jesus Christ, then you've got to recognize that it's the people who are with you right now that you must serve. I'm listening, sweetheart. And now she answers. He said, he's griping about Louis, and she thinks she's talking to his brother, but she's really talking to him. He said he was. This is exactly what he said. He said he was sitting at the table in the kitchen all by himself, drinking a glass of ginger ale and eating saltines and reading Dombey and Son. And all of a sudden, Jesus sat down in the other chair and asked if he could have a small glass of ginger ale. A small glass, mind you. That's exactly what he said. I mean, he says things like that, and yet he thinks he's perfectly qualified to give me a lot of advice and stuff. That's what makes me so mad. I could just spit. I could. It's like being in a lunatic asylum and having another patient all dressed up as a doctor come over to you and start taking your pulse or something. It's just awful. He talks and talks and talks, and if he isn't talking, he's smoking his smelly cigars all over the house. I'm so sick of the smell of cigar smoke, I could just roll over and die. The cigars are ballast, sweetheart, sheer ballast. If he didn't have a cigar to hold on to, his feet would leave the ground. We'd never see our Zooey again. There were several experienced verbal stunt pilots in the Glass family, but this last little remark, perhaps Zooey alone was coordinated well enough to bring in safely over a telephone, or so this narrator suggests. And Franny may have felt so, too. In any case, she suddenly knew that it was Zooey on the other end of the phone. She got up slowly from the edge of the bed. All right, Zooey, she said, all right. Not quite immediately. Beg pardon? I said, all right, Zooey. Zooey, what is this? Franny, you there? I'm here. Just stop it now, please. I know it's you. What in the world are you talking about, sweetheart? What is this? Who is this Zooey? Zooey Glass, Franny said. Just stop it now, please. You're not being funny. As it happens, I'm just barely getting back to feeling halfway. Grass, did you say? Zooey Grass? Norwegian chap? Sort of heavyset blonde? You're all right, Zooey. Just stop, please. Enough's enough. You're not funny. In case you're interested, I'm feeling absolutely lousy. So if there's anything special you have to say to me, please hurry up and say it and leave me alone. This last emphasized word was oddly veered away from as if the stress on it hadn't been fully intended. There was a peculiar silence at the other end of the phone and a peculiar reaction to it from Franny. She was disturbed by it. She sat down again on the edge of her father's bed. I'm not going to hang up on you or anything, she said, but I'm tired, Zooey. I'm just exhausted, frankly. She listened, but there was no response. She crossed her legs. You can go on like this all day, but I can't, she said. All I am is on the receiving end. It isn't terribly pleasant, you know. You think everybody's made of iron or something. She listened. She started to speak up again, but stopped when she heard the sound of the voice being cleared. I don't think everybody's made of iron, buddy. This abjectly simple sentence seemed to disturb Franny rather more than a continued silence would have. She quickly reached over and picked a cigarette out of the porcelain box, but didn't prepare to light it. Well, you'd think you did, she said. She listened. She waited. I mean, did you call for any special reason? She said abruptly. I mean, did you have any special reason for calling me? No special reason, buddy. No special reason. Franny waited. Then the other end spoke up again. I suppose I more or less called to tell you to go on with your Jesus prayer if you want to. I mean, that's your business. That's your business. It's a goddamn nice prayer, and don't let anybody tell you anything different. I know, Franny said. Very nervously, she reached for the box of matches. I don't think I ever really meant to try to stop you from saying it. At least, I don't think I did. I don't know. I don't know what the hell was going on in my mind. There's one thing I do know for sure, though. I have no authority to be speaking up like a spear the way I have been. We've had enough spears in this family. That part bothers me. That part scares me a little bit. Granny took advantage of the slight pause that followed to straighten her back a trifle, as though for some good reason, good posture or better posture might come in handy at any moment. It scares me a little bit, but it doesn't petrify me. Let's get that straight. It doesn't petrify me, because you forget one thing, buddy. When you first felt the urge, the call to say the prayer, you didn't immediately start searching the four corners of the world for a master. You came home. You not only came home, but you went into a goddamn collapse. So if you look at it in a certain way, by rights, you're only entitled to the low-grade spiritual counsel we're able to give you around here, and no more. At least you know there won't be any ulterior motives in this madhouse. Whatever we are, we're not fishy, buddy. Granny suddenly tried with one hand alone to get a light for her cigarette. She opened the matchbox compartment successfully, but one inept scratch of a match sent the box to the floor. She bent quickly and picked up the box, let the spilled matches fly.
I'll tell you one thing, Franny, one thing I know. And don't get upset, it isn't anything bad. But if it's the religious life you want, you ought to know right now that you're missing out on every single goddamn religious action that's going on around this house. You don't even have sense enough to drink when somebody brings you a cup of consecrated chicken soup. which is the only kind of chicken soup Bessie ever brings to anybody around this madhouse. So just tell me, buddy, even if you went out and searched the whole world for a master, some guru, some holy man, to tell you how to say your Jesus prayer properly, what good would it do you? How in hell are you going to recognize a legitimate holy man when you see one, if you don't even know a cup of consecrated chicken soup when it's right in front of your nose? Can you tell me that? Franny was now sitting up rather abnormally straight. I'm just asking you. I'm not trying to upset you. Am I upsetting you? And of course, we could ask the question at this point as well. Are we being upset? Certainly, he has pointed out to us, too, that it's essential that we see what we are doing as something being done for God, to recognize that all our actions are concerned with consecrated things. Well, Zooey goes on to explain to her that he had watched her acting in summer stock when she was not even aware that he was there. And he explains to her that the job which she has discovered is important for her is the kind of thing that she ought to do for God. You not only had a hankering to be an actor or an actress, but to be a good one. You're stuck with it now. You can't just walk out on the results of your own hankerings. Cause and effect, buddy, cause and effect. The only thing you can do now, the only religious thing you can do, is act. Act for God if you want to. Be God's actress if you want to. What could be prettier? You can at least try to if you want to. There's nothing wrong in trying. There was a slight pause. You'd better get busy, though, buddy. The goddamn sands run out on you every time you turn around. I know what I'm talking about. You're lucky if you get time to sneeze in this goddamn phenomenal world. There was another slighter pause. And then he goes on to make the final conclusion of the book, the big approach that says we ought to recognize that it is in people that we find God. It is when we see the chance given to us to serve people that we recognize the opportunity to serve God. And this is the way he explains it. There was a silence. Both saw it through without any seeming impatience or awkwardness. Franny still appeared to have some considerable pain on one side of her face and continued to keep her hand on it, but her expression was markedly uncomplaining. The voice at the other end came through again. I remember about the fifth time I ever went on Wise Child. I subbed for Walt a few times when he was in a cast. Remember when he was in that cast? Anyway, I started bitching one night before the broadcast. Seymour told me to shine my shoes just as I was going out the door with Walker. I was furious. The studio audience were all morons. The announcer was a moron. The sponsors were morons. And I just damn well wasn't going to shine my shoes for them. I told Seymour. I said they couldn't see them anyway where we sat. He said to shine them anyway. He said to shine them for the fat lady. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, but he had a very Seymour look on his face, and so I did it. He never did tell me who the fat lady was, but I shined my shoes for the fat lady every time I ever went on the air again. All the years you and I were on the program together, if you remember. I don't think I missed more than just a couple of times. This terribly clear, clear picture of the fat lady formed in my mind. I had her sitting on this porch all day, swatting flies, with her radio going full blast from morning till night. I figured the heat was terrible, and she probably had cancer, and I don't know. Anyway, it seemed goddamn clear why Seymour wanted me to shine my shoes when I went on the air. It made sense. Franny was standing. She had taken her hand away from her face to hold the phone with two hands. He told me to, she said into the phone. He told me to be funny for the fat lady once. She released one hand from the phone and placed it very briefly on the crown of her head, then went back to holding the phone with both hands. I didn't ever picture her on a porch, but with very, you know, very thick legs, very veiny. I had her in an awful wicker chair. She had cancer, too, though, and she had the radio going full blast all day. Mine did, too. Yes, yes, all right. Now, let me tell you something now, buddy. Are you listening? Franny, looking extremely tense, nodded. I don't care where an actor acts. It can be in summer stock, it can be over a radio, it can be over television, it can be in a goddamn Broadway theater, complete with the most fashionable, most well-fed, most sunburned-looking audience you can imagine. But I'll tell you a terrible secret. Are you listening to me? There isn't anyone out there who isn't Seymour's fat lady. That includes your Professor Tupper buddy and all his goddamn cousins by the dozens. There isn't anyone anywhere that isn't Seymour's fat lady. Don't you know that? Don't you know that goddamn secret yet? And don't you know, listen to me now, don't you know who that fat lady really is? Ah, buddy, it's Christ himself. Christ himself, buddy. For joy, apparently, it was all Franny could do to hold the phone, even with both hands. For a foolish half minute or so, there were no other words, no further speech. Then, I can't talk anymore, buddy. And that's the end of mine, too. I can't talk anymore, buddy.